And in the studio, I've got Crystal and Jasmine from the Cutty Go Project. Good morning, everybody.
Morning, Morena.
Morning.
So everybody knows Crystal because I interview her every month. Well, you should know by now if you're paying attention, listeners. Jasmine comes in from time to time. She is the volunteer coordinator. And you're actually on the hunt for volunteers at the moment, Jasmine.
Yes, yes, we're always on the hunt for volunteers.
Jasmine's always on the hunt for something.
Yeah.
Yes.
She only goes out of the house to find volunteers.
Totally. Yeah. Never look me directly in the eye or else you're in.
Maybe we're overstating things a little bit. Let's start off with, as I always do, the life cycle of the oi at the moment. I know there's chicks out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've been posting videos on your Facebook page of a cat snooping around a burrow and warnings about dogs.
Yeah. And we're not the only ones. Like the coastline people.
Coast care
people have also got dotterels on the beach. So
they're so vulnerable, the dotterels.
So vulnerable. Crazy, they all, yeah, like even more vulnerable. Well, actually, the little blue penguins are equally vulnerable because they're coming in and out every night and morning. So, yeah, those birds nesting on the beach are vulnerable. And we're seeing, you know, birds are coming back. We're doing a predator control. So the next thing is being aware of how pets and dogs, cats kind of impact on that. And it puts a bit more responsibility on us.
Back to my first question though. What state are the oi chicks?
What state? So they're in burrows.
As in growth state.
Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago we went out and banded the chicks that we were able to get to.
Okay.
Because some of their burrows are really long, like a couple of metres. Others are much closer by and you can reach in, and we're qualified to band them. So we've done that.
A little band on their leg.
Yeah.
And so in future years when you see them, you
learn stuff. Yeah, so you can track them in the future if they turn up again. Then people know where they come from.
Yeah.
And, so we've done that. We've got a few more to go, hopefully. So the stage they were at was that usually they fledge around Christmas, but the difference in the chicks that we saw was like they varied quite significantly from having like nearly all their adult feathers to having hardly any.
Right, okay.
So quite a difference, yeah.
So they're not all hatching on the same day.
No, definitely not. Yeah, because it can be like about a month, you know, or 3 weeks in between.
The
birds. And, some of them were really docile and really happy, and we got some beautiful photos, actually, of just these really curious, like, first time to actually see daylight when we pull them out of the burrows.
Oh.
And so it's quite like, oh, wow. And then others are, like, super feisty and pecking and, yeah. They really put up a fight, and I think those are the ones that are closer to fledging. So, yeah, it was exciting. And then we also found a couple of, like, a twin little blue penguin. So they were also in the burrows. So that was exciting to see.
You have had some losses this year. Yeah?
Yeah, we always have losses. Yeah,
right, that's inevitable.
Yeah, it's inevitable. But we haven't had a real major incursion, what we call an incursion, like when we've seen a stoat or a ferret on camera, and then we go in and they've like raided like maybe five or six burrows and literally just killed everything in the, you know, that they find.
So that video of a cat that you had on your Facebook, was that, did anybody fess up, oh, that's my cat?
No.
Was that burrow somewhere near a house?
It's on private land.
Private land.
Oh, the burrow's on private land.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's coastal, and all of the owners in the whole vicinity, landowners, have been, you know, sort of contacted, and no, none of them own cats. Several of them had seen it around before. And
Yeah, so what we do is that if we can, we do live captures of any cats, and then we can scan them for the little microchip tag.
Oh, okay.
And take them to the vets, and then they decide kind of it's a stray or a pet, or they can find out who owns it. So that's kind of how we deal with it in a kind of ethical way.
Right.
Yeah.
And you give it a stern talking to.
We do give it a stern talking to, yeah.
That's the difficulty, isn't it? Like, you can't really communicate the importance of this program to cats or stoats or anything, can
yeah,
you?
Yeah, and they wander. They wander a lot further than people realise.
Yeah.
And I've often told the story, I think, of a cat that I had way back in the day when I lived in Potaruru, and then I moved to the Hamilton area and took the cat, and the cat took off and 3 months later turned up in Potaruru.
Wow.
So when people tell me, like, their cat doesn't wander, I'm like, okay, that's your opinion.
Maybe not but that
my,
far.
But my cat went 40 kilometres. So I'm not saying that every cat has the inclination to do that. But, you know, if a cat can go 40 kilometres finding their way back home.
It can do 1 kilometre into the bush.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's,
it's just in their nature. Like, it's just
I hadn't heard that from you before, at least I don't remember it. That's quite impressive.
Yeah, it gives you a bit of perspective, doesn't it? It's not just going down the road. It's like literally has the ability to navigate across that kind of landscape.
Yeah. I was reminded yesterday that, is it Rangatahi, it's declared the subdivision to be cat-free?
Mm, yeah.
That's an interesting idea.
Well, it means that they ask people that build houses there not to bring cats. And I have literally heard of someone that built a house there and then sold it because they found out that they can't bring their cats.
Yeah.
So
someone did ask the question, yeah, how would that actually be enforced? And I think, I haven't, like, it's not like I've investigated this. I've heard people talk about in the past, if someone's not obeying a covenant in an area, there has to be legal action from the other residents. So it's quite a heavy thing to do,
yeah,
for a cat. I don't know if there's any other legal remedy. Like I keep saying, I'm not the expert on this, but that is one thing I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably you're buying into a vision for a community, and that's what they're trying to put forward. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they do have trap lines that they've asked, you know, that we've helped them put in. So local residents there trap around the peninsula, and they're also planning to do more of possum control. So,
and they've got a lot of green space there as well. Presumably they're going to have some native plants in there. So
yeah, they've got lots of
native part of the vision, actually,
yeah,
some native birds to,
yeah,
a lot of native birds to return.
Yeah, yeah, and they're already seeing it. But at the moment, like when you open up a subdivision like that, there's also lots of mice and rats. So we've been and possums turning up at people's houses. So people are pretty engaged and like really aware there, and we've got some wonderful volunteers that are checking the traps there on a weekly basis.
Well, this is kind of the tricky part of it is, if you haven't got a cat, then the mice and rat population I don't know if it explodes, but they act as a handbrake on that as well. So
yeah. Well, some cats might catch them, some cats don't. Depends.
Some cats are
depends
a bit
how
lazy.
Well fed the cat is, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are just things popping into my head at the moment. It's hard to calculate.
Back, yeah. Going back to the cats around the burrows, is that this particular ginger cat that we've seen on the cameras, it's got more and more confident over the last couple of months. So
is it quite a young one? It looked kind of youngish to me.
Yeah, we think it's a pretty juvenile, but it keeps on sort of coming back and it gets closer and closer. And at the moment, we're just about to go into the oi stage where they're coming out of the burrows. They've been fed up by their parents and they're super like chubby and fat, and they've actually got to lose some weight, turn it into muscle, spread their wings so that then they can take off.
And the way they take off too, they have to waddle over and find a cliff face or something. Mm-hmm. Am I right about that?
Yeah, or a tree.
Yeah, they spread and they're sort of just coming out now, like having a kind of look around, like actually just spreading their wings, stretching them out and building that muscle. So as this cat kind of becomes more and more confident, then in the oi's sort of coming out, we're just really worried that it's going to be a clash.
Are you going to try and catch the cat? I mean, you must want to.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got live capture traps out there ready to go.
Okay, well, hopefully it's young enough that it doesn't know what a trap is. So,
yeah.
Do you want to talk about the number of chicks at this point, Crystal?
Oh, yeah. So we've got 7 chicks that we know of.
The total. So
the total.
Yeah.
7 chicks and the 2 little blues as well. Yeah. So that's kind of average year for us.
Last year was a bit of a boomer with, I think 16 last year.
Oh,
so it was like amazing.
So. Yeah. So, oh, yes. And?
You want to do the announcement now?
Oh, yeah. Da, da, da.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we just did a bit of a tally up, and obviously we keep a pretty good record, but it's not perfect. But we know that from the numbers that we're seeing this year that we're going to fledge our 50th chick.
Awesome.
So since starting, you know, this work, so that's pretty exciting. So we're having a little celebration and just kind of putting it out there, because I think it's testimony to what this community has done from seeing no chicks fledge,
yeah,
and everything dying, and then the flourishing, and then the, you know, 50 chicks like fledging is like incredible.
Do you have an idea of how many years there were no chicks surviving?
No, it's really hard to tell.
Probably some decades, maybe?
It could be. Like, the thing is, these birds are really long-lived, so they'll keep coming back, and they keep investing in this one chick. And so you can get parents, you know, like quite young parents, like that are maybe 8 or 9 years, but they might come back for 20 years before they die themselves. And so it's, you know, that there's a massive lag before you, you know, and then slowly the population declines. But we did catch up with Graham Taylor, who's like Doc's seabird expert, and he was saying that from all the monitoring he's done around the country of these small, of his populations that he's monitoring, and all these little, you know, kind of mainland populations, they are, in general, the trend is that they are in decline. And these are some of the more resilient seabirds. And so unless they're on offshore islands, and predator-free islands, like, you know, seabirds in general are still on in decline, and they're, you know, facing some challenging conditions. And not just predators, there's also weather, storms, food supply, all kinds of things going on that are beyond our control right now. So,
well, they eat fish, so.
Yeah, and krill and squid. But, like, these birds are amazing because they can, like, if there's not much available of one, they'll go to another species. So they're quite generalist, whereas some are really specific. So despite the fact that these guys are really resilient, they still can breed on the mainland with some protection. They're really good at utilizing modified habitat.
Travel long distances.
They can travel, you know, they can shift, you know, prey species. All those things give them an extra advantage. And despite that, we're still seeing a decline.
Yeah, because they're so vulnerable when they're coming out of their nests. Just no protection.
Yeah.
And you're never going to change a species to teach it to live in a tree.
No, that's, well, maybe in a couple of million years or something, but no.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. That's not the program, the expected program.
Yeah. A little bit beyond my lifetime.
Yeah, so when was so that's the 50th one in the last few years. When was the, what year was the first?
17?
You think was the first? 2017? Okay, so the last sort of 7 years. Averaging 7 a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is about what you've got this year.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's a huge success, and it's also been reflected in other species as well, is it?
Yeah, so we did some bird counts, didn't we, Jasmine?
Yes. So usually bird counts are rolled out annually, but last year there was a gap year. But we have a couple of specialists, local Kate Richardson and Andrew Steich from DOC, and they come out, and we've got three of our different trap lines, which are up the mountain. And there's five spots on every line. And so we go up and we sit there for 5 minutes. They are called the 5 minute bird counts.
Yep.
And record any birds that are heard. So we've started to collect a pretty amazing sort of data set of
when you say record, is that you record it with pen and paper, or you've got a recording device?
Record pen and paper.
Right, okay.
And hence having the sort of specialists that can tell the kind of sparrow and a blackbird from a, you know.
Yeah, all the different birds.
Tomtit. Yeah, from a tomtit or a grey warbler or a tui.
So you've got you've got all the data in on that?
Yes, over the last few years, and then we're not quite complete this year's round, but already seeing a massive improvement in the bird life up there.
Yeah, like that, Lenny, who's been part of that bit of work and going up with them, he was saying and showing us like how, I think a couple of years ago on some of those lines they were hearing two birds, now they're hearing about 12.
Right.
So really significant increase. And we're noticing as well. And you would expect that with the amount of work that we've done, on, especially on the eastern block,
yeah.
as we call it, where we've got, you know, nearly 900 hectares of, you know, in really intensive predator control. And so you would hope that we'd start seeing, you know, increase in breeding success and an increasing number of birds. But, and of course it's all, you know, it's hard to monitor birds because they move.
Yeah.
And so you can never exactly say, but these guys are pretty experienced and there is, you know, I mean, if we consistently see that on our different monitoring lines, it's pretty exciting to see that kind of flourishing. And yeah. these kind of surveys are done at exactly the same time. And so you try and make all the variables as consistent as possible.
Yeah. And if it's a big jump like that, then you can't ignore it. You can't say that's randomness.
Yeah. And that's where monitoring regularly comes in. So we try and do this every couple of years at least.
Is it? Do you think it's... or is it a combination of more breeding happening here, but also overflow from maybe like Mangatauteri, which is... that's the one that's got the fence around it.
Yeah. And also Porongia could be as well, but a lot of those birds wouldn't travel across empty spaces.
Yeah,
so there's some that are specifically really bound by forest, and then there's others like the kaka that will travel a long way, and they've done studies where they've seen kaka from the Waikato go all the way up north. And so their range is much greater, I think, than people even expected. So we have just had reports again from people that really know, experts, that they heard kaka on Kareoi the other day. So that was really exciting. And we hear it, we're often getting reports at this time of year of them. So we don't think there's a necessarily a breeding population.
Yeah.
But they're definitely coming to visit, and there's food here for them. So that's exciting. Mm.
And this thing of the birds that don't travel, this is why these connector projects, like Bexie's off working on, Bexie Tail's working on a connector project between Mangatauteri and Porongia
at the moment. Ecological corridor. That's a
better,
which is,
better phrase, the actual phrase.
So that's sort of Bexie's, you know, leading on that with a joint with, council, landowners, iwi to create like literal corridor,
and that must build
planting and trapping.
Must build diversity and resilience into the population, the bird population.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I guess the jury is still out whether that system will work, but there's no doubt that there's a variety of birds that can go from different bush blocks and will travel and will traverse across some of that more bare, sparse landscape. Yeah. So and so every bit of, you know, forest and riparian planting and estuarine planting that has been done around here does add, you know, so it's not just about the predator control, it's also about adding habitat and the food species that those birds need.
Yeah.
You know, so it's never just one, you know, it's not a one thing, you know, is going to suit all.
And although we found with, like, the work that Harbour Care used to do that, I mean, they were just going around planting four species, but that was enough to bring in birds that then would drop seeds from other species from elsewhere. And it was just like a very simple way to do it.
Yeah.
And you could do things a bit faster if you brought in all the plants all, you know, at once.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the thing a lot of those plants that come through later, they kind of need that canopy, you know, there's those first species that colonise. And that's what they were doing. They were just using a really basic forest regeneration model where you have the first, you know, plants like tea tree will just colonise any bare earth, and because the seeds are just spread, and they just, like, you can cut a bit of clay and just leave it bare, and next thing there'll be tea tree all over it.
Yeah, I've seen that,
you know?
Yeah.
And it just colonises that, and then underneath that you get, that's, you know, like the next generation of trees and plants come through. And New Zealand forest is amazing like that. And then you can always, like, add a few other things, like, you know, purere or something, you know, that's really species specific. It's awesome, and it does bring back the birds when you plant the right stuff.
So how much of a connection is there between Mount Porongia and Kareoi?
What do you mean by connection?
Is there an ecological corridor? Are there steps that birds can take, or is it all farmland?
No, we've actually tracked it, because we're also working with
Ngāti Whakamahurangi, which is the iwi, you know, hapu out at Toraparu. And they are doing restoration there. And then there's also the work being done around Bridal Veil Falls, and then individual landowners restoring bush blocks that we've often supported. And so you get these, we don't have a corridor, but we definitely have a network that where you can trace the streams from Karioi all the way through those landscapes to Porongia. And so if we get more and more landowners on board that restore those streams and different landscapes around between kind of Karioi and Porongia, we only probably need to do about 20 kilometres of planting and we would have a corridor as well.
Okay, so it's quite close already.
Yeah, it's really doable. It's really exciting actually because, you know, there's still a lot of forest around Old Mountain Road as well and, you know, we're really not that far apart.
Yeah. It's, I guess the less productive or less fertile the soils are, the more chance that there is going to be bush around the place, or the steeper as well.
Yeah.
As farmers are like, well, it's not financially viable to try and farm steep land.
Mm.
They find something better to do with it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
even if, I suppose we get, I mean, pine trees aren't great for our native birds, like a pine forest, that probably, I doubt that's any use.
Bats.
Yeah, peka-peka.
Bats, okay.
Yeah,
so
they're not fussy on what species they...
We also have the Manuka honey producers putting... I guess they are monoculture, are they? They're just all one type of tea tree?
Yeah. There's a bit of that on the divi, isn't there? Like, lots of
Would that support some native species, do we know?
Yeah, it would do. Like... I don't know if which birds are specifically.
No, but you know that there's, you know, where there's trees, there's insects, and birds eat insects, and you know.
Yeah,
but, and the people often up in the bush or even around the sort of Apo Ainui area, and you'll see a seed like a rewa seedling or something, and look around, and there's definitely nothing around that. You know, no sort of mother trees around that area. So, like you say. You know, the seed dispersal is pretty amazing, and because it comes with a sort of natural fertilizer, then it's got lots more chance of actually surviving. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think the main takeaway for that whole conversation is just that the trees need the birds and the birds need the trees.
Yes.
And it's that, you know, that relationship. And so it's easy to kind of go, oh, who cares? It's just a dumb bird. You know, it's just this or that, you know, like, does it really matter? But it is, like, if we lose our birds, we lose so much more than just the birds. Like, we lose everything, you know, and that kind of ecosystem functioning is, you know, reliant on that interconnection and exchange between the species. And the same with our seabirds. Like, New Zealand forests thrived and became what they are because of this, the guano, the nutrients that came from the sea and were spread across the land by seabirds.
Yeah.
And not just like right on the immediate coastline, but right across the island. You know, there's records of seabirds right throughout New Zealand and right up to the highest peaks and places like Maungatauturi.
So, Craig's just sent us a message championing the planting of purari.
Oh, yes, I've got some puriri on my place, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
Why are they special?
Oh, I don't know, they're just beautiful, but they're also really connected to the kereru. So the kereru feeds on them and helps spread their seed. Yeah.
And did I see, you can tell I was looking at your Facebook page, I'm pointing it at the screen, it doesn't show it, did you have pictures of kereru chicks on there recently?
Yeah.
Scrawny looking things because they haven't got their feathers yet. Birds always look awful till they've got their feathers.
Yeah.
I think
so
there's
cool.
A story about that.
Yeah. So we've got a really dedicated landowner a little bit out of town who has been doing predator control on their own property for years and years and years. And they found this nest and they've just been able to kind of track the bird and the nest as it's gone through, the last couple of weeks, months, and kind of sending us regular updates. Mm. And if we get a chance, we might pop a little monitoring camera in there and kind of just watch the bird for a few days and get some footage. So that's on our list of things to do.
Yeah,
so
it's pretty amazing
really
getting a close-up sort of view of it because often, you know, they're way up in the trees.
Yeah.
And also you don't often, you know, when it's in your backyard like that, you actually, you know, get to see it every day rather than, you know, once or twice a month. So it's been pretty amazing getting to see the, you know, and how enthusiastic the landowner is that, you know, it's pretty much eye level, isn't it? The
Well, really? He
said he's pretty feisty. He'd like to get the camera in there.
But you know, that there's no predator, there's nothing around that sort of attacked it. So that's a pretty awesome for him to kind of see, you know, that it's rolling out.
I guess it's a rewarding time of year at the moment for everybody involved in this. Industry is the wrong word.
Mission. The mission, that's right.
Can we ask about, you've got a kids' holiday program coming up, actually starting next week, but also in January. But should we just talk about we'll talk about all of it, but especially next week.
Actually, we forgot to check if there's still availability, but let's just pretend there is. So if you are interested in getting your kids outside and doing something on our holiday program, like contact us through our Facebook page or website. And you can sign up your kids, then they go out and do lots of fun activities. The things that are on that calendar, like, it does vary depending on the day and the weather and the kids.
Yeah.
So they usually do a range of activities, but we try and have a focus each day. Having the holiday program really helps our educators kind of pull through that summer season.
Right, because you have after-school programs normally.
Yeah, and in-school programs, and they're funded. But for a holiday program, it helps pay for itself and helps to keep our staff going.
Yeah.
And, it creates another program, you know, for us to kind of connect with kids for a whole day, which is really cool. And we get to know them better. And a lot of those kids end up coming to Karioi Kids and Rangers as well. So, it's like...
Amber's got a really great team at the moment, and they're all really enthusiastic and hands-on leaders.
What sort of hands-on things are they doing?
Oh, they do all sorts, like from trapping to like building bush huts and going to the beach and doing all sorts of activities.
Orienteering.
Sometimes they just do lots of hanging out as well, because they are with, you know, us from 9 to 3. They get time out, like we've got hammocks and things that they hang up in the bush and
campfires and toast marshmallows and
all sorts of things. So yeah, and then if the weather's really bad, like we have wet weather backups, so we just put an article in, like we never cancel because of rain.
Yeah,
it's been a part of our philosophy right from the first time we started the education program, which was actually 10 years ago. So we're going to have a 10-year education program celebration early next year.
Wow, all of the milestones.
Yeah. which is actually, we were just meeting here outside this building when we had our first Karioi Kids that we ever organised, and we did it in partnership with the Environment Centre. But that was Danielle and Bexy and, you know, all the same punters that ended up also working with the Karioi Project. I remember, like, we put out the notice because we just thought we'd hang out with a few kids. And then we had, like,
didn't
20.
Didn't have any bigger plans than that.
20 turn up. And we were like, holy cow, what are we going to do? What are we going to do with all these kids? And, like, we were all, like, not that experienced at controlling the kids. And,
I've been through that. Coaching sport.
That's
probably why it was so successful.
Yeah.
It was free-spirited.
And but Amber's really got that ethos as well, as, like, she's really experienced in doing bush school type things. And, letting kids go through those little stages of boredom sometimes too, and find their own fun and explore. And we've got nets, and they play in the streams and on the rocky shore, and like all sorts of things. Yeah.
And the first one's this Friday, the end of this week.
That one isn't happening. Week.
So next week's happening.
Yeah, next week.
And then in the new year after the 10th, I can see on the schedule there lots of stuff for most of January.
So lots of stuff in January. So we're really keen to. We do need at least 5 kids to run, otherwise it becomes unaffordable for us.
Yeah.
It's always interesting, you know, because. You know, we obviously do have to charge to cover our costs, and that's transport and people's time and preparation. We don't actually make money out of it, but it's something that we want to offer in this community, and it supports lots of parents that need that service, as well as it being a really cool opportunity for us to connect these kids in nature and help them explore some areas of
whangaroa that they might not have seen before as well.
Yeah.
Lots of places we go to where the kids are like, I've never been here before. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And Jasmine, do you want to tell us all the benefits of becoming a volunteer with the Cutego Project, wow. Why somebody might want to do that? This is your job.
Yes, exactly. I like to kind of call it accountable bushwalking. Like everybody wants to kind of get out and go for a walk and do their, you know, have their bush time. But often it's just, you know, you've got washing or kids or work gets in the way. But once you sign up for a trap line, you hopefully feel obliged to go out and do it and hopefully enjoy it so much that you know, it's becomes like a regular thing.
Yeah.
So it's a nice way to kind of connect and have some sort of, you know, purpose to those bushwalks.
How much would people have to do?
There is an option for everyone. I mean, the more the traps are checked, the better. So, you know, weekly is amazing, but then we've got people that do fortnightly, monthly, bi-monthly, just basically whatever you can fit into your schedule. Some of our town lines around like Upper Wainui and Bryant, they maybe take like an hour and a half, and then some of the Manga ones are, you know, four hours, couple of hours up and an hour or so down, checking traps on the way. So you know, we've got a line for everyone.
What about if you're a bit squeamish about seeing dead animals? Have you got other things that people
you
could do?
You can definitely. Yes, we also have like every couple of months or three times a year fill bait stations. So that's like an awesome day where you basically just get a bag of bait and head up onto the mountain and fill bait stations as a bit of a team, which is amazing. But that, you know, the squeamish part of it, like initially you kind of think, oh, that this would be horrible, but you know, we prep you with all the right tools. You've got gloves and tongs and yep, all of that kind of stuff. And once you've seen, you know, a couple and realize the benefit and what you're doing to kind of help the Nahiri, then it's really, you know.
Yeah, and if you can hear the bird, I guess when you're up there, if you're starting to hear more and more bird sounds, that's just going to remind you what you're there for.
Totally, yeah, it just keeps you kind of going. And you get to, you know, see some really incredible parts of Raglan.
Yeah.
By volunteering, it's, you know, good for your mental health, you know, to get out and be amongst nature. So, yeah, lots of good reasons.
And how do people get in touch? Just online?
Yeah, online. Facebook, website, and yeah.
Or tackle Jasmine down the street.
Yeah.
You know who she is?
Yeah.
If you're downtown right now, wait for her to come out of the town hall in a few minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. There'll be a stampede now.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very, very popular.
Yeah. Yeah, no, if you're keen to sign up next year. Also, like, we do have one-off kind of, you know, like Jasmine said, like the bait station days are super cool, sometimes like 30 people.
Right.
And we put on like lots of amazing cake that especially Jasmine's mum makes and other people as well. But
volunteering's becoming popular my mum.
Who's your mum?
Jane Edgar. She used to do the pies at the market.
Yeah, I know her. I've interviewed her.
And she's so awesome, and she basically sort of does volunteering by baking and cooking. And so we definitely get a lot of repeat volunteers just so that they can have her savouries.
Savouries are good.
Another incentive.
So that's another way to
trap making workshops. So there's lots of different ways, and we're always, you know, like if you want to be involved and you are squirmish, like there's so many ways you can and help with fundraising and marketing and social media, you
cake
know,
cake baking
yeah. Like there's literally we can find you something.
So yeah. Crystal, tough question. Do you have time to do a trap line yourself?
Sometimes. So, like, I don't have
it's
a
scandalous.
I don't have a regular one. So
I think we need to change that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. No, it's interesting because I even just for work stuff, I try and kind of challenge myself to try and have one day out in the field, and I'm actually not able to do that at the moment.
It's like the school principal who never meets any kids.
Yeah. Like, well, it does help. I do make a big effort, like, to stay connected and obviously qualified. So around banding, but also just being out, you know, like four-wheel driving and, you know, being able to do the job is really important, right? But, yeah, so I randomly sometimes will go up
somewhere and then go to Jasmine, oh, I'm going up this line, or oh, I've been up this line.
Yeah.
Just in case you don't know. But probably not enough, yeah, not as much as I'd like to. And I do really love it, and love doing the bait station days. They're really special because it's hours in the bush, you know, doing stuff.
But the paperwork has to happen, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
I know that as much as I. That's the stuff I don't like.
Yeah,
for my job.
Yeah,
that has to happen.
Yeah. So another thing coming up.
Applications.
Yeah, funding applications. It's not just that. It's also meeting. Lots of meeting with people and networking. And like next year, we're going into quite a challenging funding kind of environment. Like, well, some of our bigger funds are coming up for reapplication.
Like your multi-year ones.
My multi-year ones.
That's the scary things. Like, I've avoided those multi-year things because, like, okay, you're solid for 3 years, but then.
Oh, well, yeah,
everything
but it's,
could change.
Yeah.
I'm nervous about it.
Yeah, oh, no, but they're so important. Otherwise, you're living year by year and it becomes really hard to employ people.
Okay,
so next year is a big push for us for funding. We really need to get the community on board to help support, and if people can donate, especially on a regular basis, even if it is just $5 a month even, it all helps.
Have you got a permanent give a little going?
Not a permanent give a little, okay, but so permanent donation button.
Okay,
yeah.
Donation button.
Yeah. And then we'll do a big push out on some of the Raglan markets and that, just to get backyard hub trappers going, as well as just raising awareness around, you know, what's happening in the project and in our community. Because, yeah, it definitely gives me a few sleepless nights. Kind of sometimes feeling the challenge of how to keep things. It's all very well growing a big project, but then how do you sustain it?
Yeah.
And if people seeing the value of it and the changes it makes, and, you know, there's a new government in place, and whether they have the same commitment to some of these things. You know, national government put in place the vision for predator-free New Zealand, and hopefully they'll keep committing to support that vision.
I mean, it's a universally... Yeah. People universally like the idea, so you know, no one thinks it's controversial trying to save our native species and our natural ecology. So fingers crossed.
Definitely.
Hey folks, we've been talking to Crystal and Jasmine from the Karioi Project. Have you got anything else you want to chuck in there before we go? You've done your volunteer call out, sold the idea of being
bring
a volunteer.
It. Bring them on, bring it on.
Volunteer, donate, and trap in your own backyard. That's what we always say. Look out for, you know, like for, you know, things that come out on our Facebook page.
You can help people trap in their backyard.
We can also help. We can help, and then we send you a bill at the end of the month. For that help.
Okay,
so there's a paid service,
but you can give advice as well? Or
yeah, we give advice. We can give people traps that they can purchase off us, and they can trap themselves, and we also have a trap library.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so really there's absolutely no barriers to doing this stuff, and it's awesome, and it's great to get your kids involved, and yeah, I guess we should... Wish people a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
It is that time of
year.
Yes. All right. Hey, thanks for coming in, guys.